Welcome to Mid-Century Modernism with Monique, your go-to podcast for all things architecture, design, and innovation within mid-century modernism. Join me on a journey through the golden age of design, where every episode brings you fresh inspiration for modern living and unlocks the secrets of this iconic and timeless style. What are we waiting for? Let's get started. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Mid-Century Modernism with Monique. I'm Monique Anton, your host, and I'm delighted today to have Bob Swat on the show. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Monique.
So Bob is the partner at Swat & Partners and a brilliant architect. We're going to be talking about his love of mid-century modern architecture and his work that he's doing today. So why don't we just get started? Couple questions for you. I watched the Man of Steel documentary, which you were great in, and you talked about Bev Thorne and his work. What inspired you most about Beverly David Thorne's work?
Well, I met Bev about 20 years ago when I was introduced to him by one of my clients, and that was Lilith Kapoor. And he had a friend of Bev Thorne's and wanted Lilith to meet him and wanted me to meet him. So I met Beverly, and I didn't know anything about him, except I had heard the name, and I had heard that he had designed one of the case study houses. And I thought, wow, I'd love to meet this guy. And I met him, and I thought there was such a contrast between his work and Bev as a person. So his work is absolutely powerful. You know, I had seen the Brubeck House, so I knew about that, and I had seen photographs of the project in Marin that was one of the case study houses, and I hadn't seen much more than that, but those are powerful buildings, you know, powerful steel framing, steel construction, and you would think that he might have this very deep voice, and he might be this really strong speaking guy, and he was kind of like shy. And almost a little bit like the shoulders went up and he said, "Aw, shucks." You know, you'd say your work is amazing. You know, you've left this amazing legacy. And he goes like, "Aw, shucks." You know, it's just that's the kind of guy he was. He was just this very sweet, you know, soft spoken guy who never, you know, bragged about his work. And if you started talking about his work, he'd get this funny smile. And that's what I remember the most is the contrast between Beverly being such a modest and quiet person and his work being so powerful.
So powerful and so risky.
Yes, at that time, I think he may have been one of, if not the only, architect who was using steel to frame his buildings. And not only that, he was doing the engineering, which was pretty amazing. And I believe he was doing some of the welding. I think he was telling me stories about that. He really enjoyed working with the steel, and he enjoyed engineering the steel as well. So he was very well-rounded. He had a lot of skills. But I also remember that after looking at his buildings, that he was just a real good architect. So whether they were framed in steel or they would have been framed in wood, they were just really well-planned, wonderful, wonderful buildings.
Yeah,
he was a great guy.
You talked in that documentary about rational logic, and you said the steel is used as an expressive element and that these homes really come alive and these expressive elements are necessary. Can you share your thoughts about that, about your rational logic?
Well, I feel that architecture, the most successful architecture, has a component which is rational. That has to do with planning. It has to do with structure. It has to do with how you build. It has to do with costs. It has to do with all the materials that you use. And then a part of it is from another realm. It's this more subjective realm. And that's where the buildings become poetic. And so by having a sort of equal degree of rational thought and then this more poetic sort of vision, I think putting the two together creates a sort of a whole that I like a lot, because I have seen plenty of buildings that are all rational, and I've seen plenty of buildings which are all poetry, and I like the ones best where there's this really nice mixture of rational thought and the poetry of architecture.
Absolutely. You mentioned in, there was another film that I watched about you, the Sonoma Living that you were in, and you talk about three basic ideas about West Coast modern architecture. Can you share those three basic ideas with us?
Sure. So this was around 1995, and I had finished a building up in the Oakland Hills, and I will admit it, I was not happy with the results, and I was not happy with what I had created. And so I did some soul searching and said, well, what's really important in architecture, in the kind of architecture that I want to do, and which is homes and residential, smaller type of buildings. And I gave some thought to it, and there were three ideas that I've sort of lived by ever since then. So it's been a long time, not since 1995. And the first one, which we talked about, which is knitting the building to the land so that the building feels natural on its site. And when it looks like it couldn't have been anywhere else and nothing else could have been there instead of that building, then you've just hit the nail on the head, okay? So yeah. That's knitting the building to the land. The second one has to do with how we live. And how we live on the West Coast, we live pretty informal lives. You know, we're not formal. We don't have lots of rooms and doors and separation between spaces, and we can open up our spaces for less formal living. And when we have open planning to accommodate that, both horizontally with less doors and walls and vertically with openings that are multi-stories, then we get incredibly exciting spaces as well as just open spaces, but really exciting spaces. And so that's the sort of the second principle, which I think is a timeless principle of modern architecture on the West Coast. And the third one is the one that everybody talks about, and that's connecting inside and outside. And yes. That's a lot of glass, but it's also a lot of doors, and how do the doors operate, and how do you make it seamless from inside to outside? Maybe you carry materials from the inside to the outside, and maybe you bring outside to the inside with maybe taking landscape and bring it right into the middle of the house, like we're doing on a home right now, where we're taking the garden and bringing it into the center of the home. And we take the materials out into the landscape. So that's the third thing. And I think if you do all three of those, you know, to a pretty high degree, you know, you'll have some degree of success.
That's right. Well, I've seen many of your homes and you have succeeded for sure. Toured 40 Firethorn, which was an experience. And
thank you.
You know, your homes are larger than life, but I have to tell you, when I met you, I remember thinking, oh my gosh, he's so down to earth. He's so modest. He's so relaxed. And you have this humbleness that you work with that I think is so necessary to create these homes. It's pretty amazing what you do.
Thank you.
Back to these wonderful architects. You have a connection to Rudolf Schindler that I learned about. And I would love for you to share with our listeners the story that you told me about.
Well, I have, you know, some connections to a few amazing architects. I don't know how this really happened, you know, that I chose a career and there was a connection there that naturally, as a little boy, I didn't know about. Mm-hmm. But my grandmother, I grew up in L.A., on the west side of L.A., and the family store at that time was the Nobby Knit Shop. It was the first women's wear store in L.A. and the first women's wear chain. And their first or second store that they opened up was at Hollywood and Vine, that famous intersection. And the storefront was designed by Rudolf Schindler for mm-hmm. my grandmother, which is just kind of amazing. Now, I found this in a book that had been published in Germany. I haven't found that book here in the U.S. I looked it up. My mother was alive at that time. I showed her pictures and didn't ask her what it was. And I said, tell me, have you ever seen anything like this? This is just to confirm. And she said, oh yeah, that was the store. I worked there with my mom. Yeah, so it's kind of a fun story. And the other connection to a famous L.A. architect was that I went to Emerson Junior High School, which was designed by Neutra.
Oh, amazing.
And he had designed these incredible classrooms that were open to the outside, so you could have classes outside or you could have classes inside. And, of course, with the weather in L.A., you could actually use the building that way. So that's another nice connection.
It So amazing. Well, I've studied your works, and you've not only created these beautiful residential homes and also, you know, these larger than life modern masterpieces. You have designed smaller homes, and I watched a little video on the tea houses that you that you designed, and these are in Saratoga. Can you share this experience of this these beautiful little homes? And and the homes actually float, you know, they're floating, and they have all of these design elements that are really amazing.
Sure. Well, we had a client who had a large home in Saratoga, and he asked us to renovate and add on to that building. And so it was actually a big residential project, and we did renovation, added on to it. It's a beautiful home, and it came out really, really great. And one of the nicest clients I've ever worked with, just a wonderful person. And toward the end of the project, he said, Bob, I want to go for a walk with you. And I said, sure, where do you want to go? He says, I want to go up in the hill. He had a lot of land, so beyond his house, we walk up into a hill. And he shows me a tree, and he looks here, he says, I want to build three tea houses. And I said, well, tell me about the tea houses. He says, well, they'd be for three purposes. One would be for having tea or conversation. One would be for sleeping, like a little guest house. Mm-hmm. And maybe that would be connected by a bathroom to a third one, which is a place to work. And I said, oh.
Wow.
And tell me more. Why did you choose this exact location? He said, well, this is the most beautiful area of my site. He says, I feel like I can talk to the Dalai Lama when I'm here.
Oh,
and I said,
gosh.
Oh. And I got chills. I got excited. And then I said, tell me what a tea house is like. And he says, well, I want it modern, and you just design it. So that was that.
The trust that he had with you.
Well, we had a good relationship. The house had gone very, very well. I think I was very happy with it, and I really believe he was as well. Mm-hmm. So I went back to the office, and we built a lot of models. I think more models than any firm in the region. And so I started, and I actually built these myself, little tiny models to show what the concepts were for these little tea houses. Mm-hmm. And I still have those to this day. And I probably had like six different ideas of what they would be like. Is it a band shell? Is it a box? Is it a round? Is it a sphere? What is it? And how would you site it? And how would you connect it to the land or detach it from the land? And so I came up with this one idea, which was this glass box supported by two concrete core elements, so that it lifts it off the ground. So like you could actually take these boxes and you could put them on the slope, you could put them on the flat, you could put them anywhere because they're lifted off the ground. The cores lift them to exactly where they want to be. And then you'd have a little step to get into it. And so that's really it. And then we framed it in both steel and wood. It's the boxes are completely glazed, it's all glass, and the supports are all cast-in-place concrete. And so it's a very, very simple party. It's a very simple idea. But you put three of them together and...
Oh, my gosh.
They're...
It's stunning.
They're nice. I'm proud of them. They came out great.
Stunning. In one of your lectures, you talked about Ray Caffey.
Yeah.
And Ray Caffey was a mentor of yours. And... I wondered if you could share a little bit about his work, and you have a story about him that I wanted to share with our audience.
Well, this may be a little bit embarrassing, but I'll try it anyway. So the year was 1966, if you can think back that far, and I had finished my first year at UC Berkeley, and I'm a kid, okay, and I don't know how to spell architecture, okay? I've just been goofing off my first year at Berkeley. And I come back for the summer and decide, well, I'm going to get a job, okay? What kind of job? Well, see if I can work for an architect, find out what that's all about. So I came home and I asked my dad, I said, who are the architects in L.A. I should talk to? He said, oh, I think you should talk to Albert C. Martin, and you should talk to Luckman and Pereira. And I said, oh, okay, so these are the big shots. So I opened up the phone book, figured out what the phone number was. I called them up. And I figured, I'll work for free. They have to hire me, right? I'll work for free. So I reached the receptionist. I can't get past the receptionist. She says, no, we're not hiring. And I said, what if I work for free? No, we don't need any help. So I couldn't even get in the door. So I'm sitting there in Westwood where I grew up. And I said, well, I wonder if there's any architect who like works near me, you know, where
right.
I am.
Right.
So I pick up the Yellow Pages and I went through the Yellow Pages and I find a few names in there. And I saw one that was right very close by to where we lived. And so, and that happened to be Raymond Cappy. Didn't know who he was, but I go into the building and he's actually on upstairs above a hardware store at that time. And I say, and I see this guy with this big beard and I say, hi, I'm looking for Raymond Cappy. He says, I'm Raymond Cappy. And I said, hi, I'm Bob Swat. I'm a student at UC Berkeley and I'd like to work with you for the summer. And instead of sending me away, he says, come on in, Bob. And he talked to me for a long time. So I took in my portfolio. And my portfolio consisted of, I think, this one little beginning of a building that we were working on. But the main thing that we did is we built these little systems out of, like, toothpicks. And so they were like dodecahedrons or tetrahedrons and all these things stacked together to make all these systems. And as I'm talking to him, he says, well, explain that project to me. And so I explained that project to him. And I said, well, it's not architecture, but it's, you know, it's these systems that we're working on. And he says, oh, it's not architecture? And I said, no, it's not, because I'm thinking architecture, you have to have some sort of life inside of it, and these are just geometric. Right. So the second time he says, no, that's not architecture, huh? I said, well, I don't think so. And then by the third time that he said, that's not architecture, I looked at him and I said, and I'm really a dumb kid at that time, and I said, you know, Mr. Cappy, maybe it is architecture. He looked at me and he says, you know, I would consider any rational structure that encloses space to be architecture.
Amazing.
I was shocked. I was shocked. And after that, he asked me a question about, it was really funny. He said, whose work do you like better? And it was Lou Kahn or one of the big architects in L.A. And I said, Mr. Cappy, I'm not familiar with their work, which was true. I was a one-year student. I hadn't taken a history class. I didn't know their work. And he looked at me, and he kind of smiled, and he says, Bob, I like you, but you may not know as much as you think you know. And my answer was, where'd you get the idea that I think I know anything? I just finished, you know, my first year at Cal, you know. And he says, I'll tell you what I want you to do. Go home, write an essay on the meaning of architecture. Bring it back. I'll hire you for the summer.
Wow.
Well, yeah. Was that a gift or what? So what did I do? I went home. I interviewed with Dan Dworsky that afternoon. Took that job. Never wrote the essay. And Ray and I became best friends.
Wow.
We became best friends. So for the rest of my career at Cal, I would every time I would finish a project, I would get a critique up in Berkeley. And then I'd go to L.A. and I'd get a critique from Ray Cappy, who was a great teacher as well as a great architect. So I would get two perspectives on every project I did. And the perspectives from Northern California architects was really different than Ray Cappy. So I really learned a lot from this man.
Wow.
Okay. And we became dear, dear friends. And many, many years later, I was on the Alumni Association for the College of Environmental Design, and they started a program called it was the Alumnus of the Year Award. Okay, and for the first year to commemorate 100 years of the School of Architecture at UC Berkeley, I nominated Ray to be the first recipient, and of course he won. And he came up to the Bay Area, and he and Shelley stayed in our home. And then we went out to the Greek Theater for the cap and gown thing.
Wow.
Special as a way to say thank you.
That's so, so special.
That's a little bit of my story with Ray.
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah. So he went to your home, and your home is in Lafayette.
Yeah.
Right? And you said in an interview, I saw this a couple years ago, that you had an aha moment with your home in Lafayette where you said it's like the house wanted to be here. And that really hit me. That resonated with me when you said that.
Well, I think that's the same principle that we've talked about. You know, when it's right and you know it and you get it and you can't see anything else on that site. So that house was the first house where I put the first those three principles to use.
Yes.
And that's our home today, and it's been a great home.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
And for those of you listening, you could see all of these homes that we're talking about and these visuals on the website SWATpartners.com. It's very exciting. I suggest you check that out. You talked about spatial excitement, and I have not heard an architect talk about homes as, you know, these exciting, whimsical spaces. As you know, you really have explain things in a very different way. Can you share with our audience the spatial excitement? And you were talking about specifically when you were going through the Ouyang homes. Hmm. You were talking about the spatial excitement in them, which I would love to share with our audience your ideas on that.
Well, sure. So one of the other principles of really good modern architecture on the West Coast for me is designing informal places to live as opposed to formal. Fewer doors, fewer windows, more openings in floors to connect spaces. And so when you do that and you have open planning, fewer walls and doors and all of that, you have the potential. It's not automatic. You have the potential for creating very exciting spaces. And the Ouyang house that we just finished in Atherton, I think, is a really good example of it, one that I'm really proud of. So one of the nice things about designing homes is you can, if you get a chance, design the progression of space and how you experience space, how you experience home, and you can kind of orchestrate it as opposed to, well, this is the room, this is this room, this is that room, but you can actually orchestrate the experience. How do you come into a home? How do you find the front door? What do you find after you enter a building? And is the space exciting? Is it dull? Can you see more than just the entry? So in the Ouyang house, we're on a flat piece of land in Atherton, okay? So the drama is certainly not topography, because there wasn't any. All right, so where was the drama going to come for this building? And it really came from space, okay? It's the idea of, again, open planning horizontally and vertically. So when you enter that building, the first thing you do is you park your car, and you can't see the front door, but there's a pathway that leads you through a garden to get to a pathway that leads you to the front door, okay? And the path and all of these pathways and landscaping were just fantastically designed by Stefan Tulo, who did just a beautiful job. And then as you approach the building, this really long walkway, and to the left of the walkway is this long linear water feature that takes you right to the front door, okay? But you pass underneath this overhang held up by a trellis that's very, very low. So you enter this building really low, kind of like Frank Lloyd Wright would enter a building very low, and then it would explode, right? That's a typical Frank Lloyd Wright treatment of space. Well, this is a little different. You come in extremely low, you open the door, it's already two stories, and then it gets low again because you walk underneath the bridge. And when you walk underneath the bridge, you wonder, where am I going next? And then you come out from being underneath the bridge and the space explodes. And you're in a two-story space, which is the living, dining, let's call it the public areas of the house. And up above the bridges, above the bridge that you've walked underneath, and above some of the spaces that you can see, some of the pathways that are happening upstairs, there are windows, there are clear stories, there are skylights, lights coming from all different directions. And when you look up there, some of it you can't even see where the light's coming from. You only see the light. So it's actually a very exciting experience. It's a very bright interior, even in the middle of the building, and yet you don't know where the light is coming from. So it's spatially and in terms of light quality, it's an exciting experience. It really is an exciting experience. And then of course when you're in the main space and you look out directly to the backyard, it's gorgeous with gorgeous gardens, and it's just fabulous. But the spatial experience is really special. I always like to talk about how we take, you know, elements from the interior to the outside to make the, you know, the separation from inside and outside disappear. And so sometimes we'll take a material from the outside, from the inside, and we'll take it outside. Well, on this building, we took an element from outside and we brought it inside. So we have a series of these very beautiful boulders outside the living space and the dining space, except one's missing because we took it from outside and brought it inside, and it's underneath the stair.
Oh my God.
What that stair is about. And I had so much fun.
Brilliant.
Going with Stefan, selecting the stones. I mean, architects don't get a chance to do that often, but it was such a key part of the house. I wanted to be part of that. So we selected those stones, and we got this beautiful stone and brought it inside and had like the rest of the stones outside. So that's just my way of explaining. We took the outside, brought it in, the inside, brought it out, and it just feels very special. It's a special home for a very special family.
Wow. One of my favorite designs of yours, since I'm such a purist, you know, I'm a big fan of organic architecture. I like all of that wood and glass, just those organic materials, is moss rock in Healdsburg.
That's interesting.
And the workroom of complete wood and glass is something that I could sit in for the rest of my life. Can you explain that experience?
Sure. Many years ago, we designed the home that has moss rock in the back, okay? And the home was a beautiful home that we had designed, and the previous owners had sold the building to the new owners, who came to us and said, Bob, we'd like to do a remote studio. And they had a couple of different ideas of where that might happen on the property. It's a large property up in Healdsburg. And they also fell in love with the tea houses and asked me if I would do something like that. And I said, well, I won't repeat myself because I didn't feel it was right. I said, but it could be inspired by that, and that would be fine.
Right.
So we found a spot that I felt was right, which was right on axis of the house is it's on the axis of actually a ridge on the property. The house follows the ridge, so it's a long linear house. And then at the end of the house, let's call it the back area of the house, that ridge extends for another couple hundred feet. And it was at the end of that ridge where we decided that would be the place to put this little building. And so the building's actually sited half on flat area and half on this really steep decline. So that gave us a really good reason to lift the building up with these two core elements. Except unlike the original tea houses, it's not framed in steel, it's framed in wood. It's all clad in wood. All the windows and doors are wood. So it is the warmest of interiors, just glass and wood. It's just this pure little room. We asked them if they wanted a bathroom in their space. No, they didn't. Just a pure little room. I love walking into that space and seeing, you know, the music system set up and the turntable that looks just all by itself. Everything is so pure. The clients are both designers. They're very, very special people. And it's a lovely, lovely, lovely project. And we're proud of it. And I'd like to work in that space too.
One of your designs that has the most amazing view that I've looked at in your collection is 121 Toyin Lane in Sausalito.
Oh, yeah.
And that, looking through those images, I really saw your connection to Richard Neutra.
Yeah.
And I saw that sleek boldness, that very simple, pure, bold architecture. Can you share with us a little bit about that estate and how you angled that so perfectly on the site? It's
okay. Well,
really,
I'm happy to tell you about that. It's interesting that you brought it up. That was an addition and a complete gut and renovation of a Roger Lee house. It was a one-story, the only Roger Lee house I've ever worked on, a one-story post and beam, fabulous home, way too small for the family that bought it, and they hired us to do an addition to this building, and it's pretty obvious what we did because we did the second story. It wasn't there.
Mm-hmm.
It was a one-story building. So what I tried to do was just be really respectful to the building and to all of the exposed structure, the post and beam, all the glazing modules, you know, everything that Roger Lee had planned, but I updated it. You know, we redid all the fireplaces. We'd added this beautiful stairway and created this master bedroom suite on the upper level and made it look like as though it was pretty much like the original building. Although it was a little bit more bold because of adding that second floor, of course. But I think it was a very successful project. And it was nice to work on a Roger Lee house. It was a really nice building.
Amazing. Yeah. So you have 4 books, right? Or is it 3 and the fourth one's coming out?
Well, yeah, we've had 3 books.
Yes.
And we're planning to do a fourth one.
Okay.
And so, I started the firm in 1975. And next year will be 50 years. Okay? Now, I know that sounds like a long time, but as I mentioned when we met, I feel like I'm just getting started. So yes. Sort of to commemorate that and to also talk about the future and the kind of work that we're doing, we're thinking of doing a book called 50 Houses, 50 Years, or maybe it's 50 Years, 50 Houses, or something like that. Mm-hmm. And so we thought we'd pick 50 of the best or most interesting houses that we've done. And so we're working on that right now. It's fun. It gives me a chance to think about the ideas, because I think the ideas are more important than a lot of the photographs. Right. And also some of the early work, which was very kind of experimental. I was trying to learn about architecture and learn from the masters and all of that. So, you know, so there's some of that. And so those are the thoughts. But it's in the early stages. We've just started working on it.
Mm-hmm.
Selecting the projects right now. But we're planning on doing that. So it's an exciting little project.
Yeah. Well, I ordered Livable Modern. That's on Amazon. And I think you can get every one of these books on Amazon very conveniently. Going back to the homes, one home that I have not seen in person, but I'm fascinated with it, is also in Tiburon, the Garay house.
Yes.
And this house, just the visuals online instantly make you calmer from seeing this house.
Yeah.
Can you share with us a little bit about this design?
Yes, sure. First of all, there was a building there, okay? And that building was as I recall, it was a plywood building. It was not in good condition at all, but it had the best view, you know, in the Bay Area. Okay, and our clients wanted to turn this into a really fabulous permanent home. And that's what we did. I mean, basically, we worked with what was there. We added what wasn't there. We chose extremely beautiful materials and worked with the owners, and they helped find some of the materials. And to me, that building feels so classically, almost Neutra-esque. You look at that, and it, not by intention, but that's just when I look at it, I say, wow, that's what we did. And it feels very like from another era to me. And it is calm, and it is beautiful.
Yes.
And I will say this, that one thing that my wife said when we went to an event there, she said, you know, Robert, this is the only house you could get me to move to.
That's perfect.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Well, I think your designs, there's a collective, you know, zen about all of your homes. And I love how you and I were talking about how our work is play. We enjoy what we do so much that it's, you know, I look at the time sometimes after a showing and I can't believe that I'm working.
Yeah,
it's like a you know, a fun hobby or something.
I just read an article about Warren Buffett, and his son was talking about what he learned from his father. I was on I forget what news program, and the son was talking about how his dad taught him to be sure and find something that you love, so that you never have to work. And he said that lesson has stayed with him. I tell all my kids that. I've always told them, find something that you love. Luckily for me, I found something that I love, so that if I won the lottery tomorrow, I'd still be doing this. That's why I say, you know, after all these years, I'm just getting started, because it's so much fun.
I love that. And with everything that you know, and with all of the, you know, we make mistakes and we learn and we improve. This is the start for you. This is a really exciting new beginning. So
yeah, it is. Yeah, it is.
And other projects that you can share for the future that you're working on, or?
Oh yes, we have a whole series of homes that we're working on. We had a very exciting project we've been working on. It's called Pine Mountain. It's near Mendocino. We have a really nice project, which I can explain a little bit to you. It's in Atherton. I probably can't mention names at this point, but it's, if you can imagine, a two-story building on a, you know, smallish lot. And to bring light into the building, we created an atrium, right? We also created a basement. And the atrium doesn't stop at the first floor. It goes to the bottom of the basement. And what is at the bottom of the basement where this atrium ends? A garden with plants that grow up three stories. So that the entire building, is all the spaces are surrounding an indoor garden. We'll see how well it works, but we're working on that right now. I'm very excited about it. Mm-hmm. Really exciting concept.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, I can't wait to view that and your other projects. And from our audience around the world here, thank you so much for creating these homes that we fall in love with. And I can't wait to see what you do next.
Thanks so much, Monique. I appreciate it.
Thanks for tuning in to today's episode. I hope you had as much fun learning about the world of mid-century modernism as I did. You can also catch the show on my YouTube channel, where we walk through some of the most stylish mid-century modern homes in California. Just search for Mid-Century Modernism with Monique and hit subscribe. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast and leave me a comment to let me know what you think. Your feedback helps me make the show even better. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time on Mid-Century Modernism with Monique.